sophomore year of high school, honors English class. And I know, everyone knows, it's Thursday, and like every Thursday, I brace myself. 10:26, 10:27, 10:28, 29, 30. You look up from our desk, teacher nods, and then every single person in the class gets up and walks out. Time for the National Honor Society meeting. Yeah, every single person in this class gets up and walks out. Every single person. But me. See, the other kids in Honors English all have something in common. They're honors everything else, too. They're honors math, honors chemistry, honors history, honors this, honors that. Goodie for them. At least, I think I'm pretty good at this English stuff, the reading, the writing. And you know, everyone needs something they can do. And this is my thing. Our teacher had said that only the finest young minds could maintain the rigor and depth for her classroom. Shakespeare, Beowulf, Chaucer, I dig it. And the week prior, she told us to write about the storming of the French Bastille. Turns out it's crazy stuff with guillotines, treachery, let them eat cake. I get into it. And so this morning after everyone leaves, I sit there alone, staring at the teacher. She stares back at me and she looks angry. And finally she says, "We need to have a talk about your assignment." Then she holds up my paper, my Bastille paper, and there's a big F marked on it. "This paper is an obvious plagiarism." "What? You copied this out of a book." "I wrote that." "What book?" "I don't know which book, but I do know that you didn't write it. I've informed the principal you are hereby dismissed from the honors English class. Go see your counselor for reassignment." "But I didn't." "Get out!" I can't believe it. I go to my counselor what happened, and he says, "Well, you know, this is not the type of thing that looks good in your permanent record." I didn't do anything. He hands me a slip with a new class assignment on it. It reads, "Creative Writing," which is what they called English for Dummies. "No, I didn't do anything wrong." "No more cheating on papers, okay?" And I can barely speak. Language is the only reason anyone's ever called me smart. And now I don't even have that. I get to the class, and my new teacher, Mrs. Cox, is not happy to see me. "Whatever discipline problems that got you sent here, let's see that they're not repeated." I sit in the back and hear all the, "What you do, what you do, what you do, what you do?" I don't answer. Miss Cox gives us an assignment to write a poem about something that means something or something or another. Screw her. Screw the counselor, screw the principal, screw everybody. Poem. I'm going to have my own good time. I imagine this English-accented villain. And write. "I wake with the madness. Possessed with the need, 'tis only one thing on which I must feed. I know where they keep it. Yes, there's a place. I care not for title, not distinction, not grace. I crawl toward the chalice, a glowing white bowl. Therein lies my challenge. I seize now my goal. And the madness, it's lifted. But in my throat there is a lump. For I had reached inside a toilet after teacher took a dump." Miss Cox rifles through the assignments, reads mine aloud, rolls her eyes, says something about broken meter, and that's it. Which makes me kind of upset, because that would have got me booted from honors English class for sure. But she plays us the Bride of Frankenstein, and says that our next assignment is to write a monster story. Understand. Please understand, nobody. But nobody knows from monsters like I know monsters. So that night, fire in the belly. I pen an opus combining horror, sci-fi, and speculative fiction into a single creature that has big plans for the good-looking hero. When I walk into class with the story, Miss Cox snatches it out of my hand, sits down, and starts reading before she even says hello. I watch her as she laughs, gasps, shakes her head, and then gets real quiet. I wait for her reaction as she turns the final page for my final surprise. It's all been a trap for just this moment. I wait. She reads, and her mouth drops open. She looks up at me. No way! And that reaction, her reaction, maybe my first moment of pure joy. From then on, I write. I write every day to make Mrs. Cox cry, to make her laugh, to make her mad. I write and I write and I write, and I never make it to the Honor Society. I never make it to Honors English. But if it wasn't for a bit of an academic detour, if it wasn't for Mrs. Cox, I don't know if I would have made it at all. Today, on Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, Detour. Amazing stories from real people crashing up against that roadblock. My name is Glenn Washington, and my teacher's name was Daylin Cox, whom I've never properly thanked before. So I can thank her now in front of over 1 million snappers. Thank you, Mrs. Cox. Always remember and never forget that you're listening to Snap Judgment. I'm going to kick off today's Snap Judgment Detour episode on the Snap Stage, because at Snap Live, one of our favorite storytellers, Kate Ascott Evans, she dropped a family story from her very special brand of family, Snap Judgment.
We are standing outside a big gray concrete building in Cape Town. My dad is very excited, which is making me nervous. Well, Kate, just you wait until you see your surprise present. I want it to be a spa day. And I'm thinking it could be a spa day because my dad and I, we aren't getting on and he wants us to bond. My mom is having a breakdown, and I'm back in South Africa taking care of her. So my dad and I are living together for the first time since I was a kid when my parents split, and it is not going well at all. We do not know how to be father and daughter. Even my mother, who is in a psychiatric hospital, said, "Do you really think that's the best thing for your sanity?" So, the surprise. My dad, he opens the door, he struts up to the receptionist, and he announces, "We have an appointment." There are like 100 jars of jam on her counter. "Look, they have fig jam. Your favorite, Kate, buy some fig jam." "Well, that's very special jam. It's actually the last batch Mrs. Conradi made before she left us." "Left you?" "Well, passed away." "Probably not a spa." I clutch my dead woman's fig jam. He points down the hall. There stand a group of white-haired people playing bingo. "This is an old age home." Well, if my dad thinks we are putting my 59-year-old mother in this place, he's got another thing coming. It is a tiny, tiny room. There's no bed. But there is a cot. Well, Kate, what do you think of your surprise? What do I think of my surprise, Pop? I think Mom is not gonna like this place. Mom? What? Kate, I didn't get this for your mother. I got it for you. Wait, you got me a room in an old age home? Yes! Pop, I'm 26! Exactly. You keep saying you want me to treat you like an adult. And so I was thinking she probably needs her own space. And then we got very lucky, Kate. One of my patients just died. So this place, it's just sitting here, fully paid for. I mean, it's really great timing. You want to be a writer? Here's a captive audience. Pop, that's because they can't go anywhere. Will you stop getting hung up on that, Kate? Really, it's just a free apartment where you can live by yourself, away from me, away from him. So that's what this is about. I throw myself onto the cot and say, I'm your daughter, Pop. Why don't you want me to live with you? But I do. Well, so then why did you rent me a room here? Well, because I thought you don't like living with me. I just seem to make you so unhappy. He sits down on the cot. I watch my father's shoulders slump. And I can see he's trying, which is more than I've been doing. He's trying to be my dad. A very confused and overeager dad, but still, that's my dad. So I pick up my dead woman's fig jam, and I stand up and I say, look, Pop, this is a great place, but if I want to live under the same roof as a cranky old guy, I want that old guy to be you. All right, Kate, if you're sure. Oh, I'm sure, Pop. I am very, very sure. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so very much, Kate. That original score was created by Alex Mandel and performed by Alex Mandel and the Snap Judgment players, David Brandt and Tim Frick. When Snap Judgment returns, someone goes out to sea. Someone joins the circus and somebody finally gets what they truly deserve. With Snap Judgment, the Detour episode continues. Stay tuned. Did you know that the month of Movember is upon us? Are you growing out an epic handlebar mustache? Well, good for you. I can't, it's these damn genetics. But know that Harry's.com is the official razor partner of Movember. And it's going to be there for you the entire hairy month. Whether or not you grow out your mustache, or you're with me and just want to keep it looking smooth, with Harry's, you can get an amazing shave and do good by supporting Movember's quest to fund research on important men's health issues. Harry's.com, was started by two guys passionate about creating a better shaving experience for all men. In order to go first class, Harry's actually bought a blade factory in Germany that's been crafting some of the world's highest quality blades for almost a century. Now you know. Never go to the drugstore again for blades. And Harry's starter shave set starts at just $15, delivered. That includes the razor, three blades, and your choice of Harry's shave cream or their awesome new foaming shave gel. And Harry's just released their aftershave moisturizer. Feels so good. Did I mention shipping is free? Satisfaction guaranteed? Go to harrys.com now. And Harry's will give you $5 off if you type in my code SNAP with your first purchase. That's Harry's, HARRYS.com. Enter the coupon code SNAP at checkout for $5 off and change the way that you shave forever.
Thanks for listening to Snap. There's so much new to watch, listen to, read, and discuss. Whether you're binge-watching, downloading, or looking for the next great read, NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast calls out the best, most creative, and most fun things out there. Something new to make you happy. Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Find it on iTunes under podcasts.
Support for Snap Judgment comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Detour episode. Today, we're exploring what happens to people when they're forced to make a very sharp turn. For our next story, we're heading out to the Philippines for one man's epic battle against the forces of nature.
Captain Randy Lucero was standing on the deck of his cargo ship, the Eva Jocelyn, when he got news that a storm was coming towards the Philippines. He moved the big 150-foot steel vessel into a cove, and he gave the order for his crew to get ready. Then the word came in over the radio. This storm was different.
Nung mating yung bagyo.
When Typhoon Yolanda came, we were anchored over there. By 5 a.m., the winds were very, very strong. We steered into the waves, but the waves were just too strong for us.
Yolanda turned out to be a massive Category 5 super typhoon. The wind speeds were so fast, they broke the measuring equipment. Captain Lucero and his crew were trying to stay afloat in the strongest storm ever to make landfall in the history of the world.
After 1 hour, we really could not control the ship anymore. The sea was so strong, and we had zero visibility. We could not see anything. You could only see as far as the guy standing beside you. We had no idea what was going on. I was very scared. All of our life jackets went flying off. We were crawling around the deck trying to find these plastic gallon jugs so we could grab onto them and use them to float. The wind was so strong that it could blow us right off the deck. This is it. There was nothing more we could do. We thought, if God is going to take us now, He's going to take us. That is it.
He and his crew huddled together in the pilot room of the ship as the storm tossed the boat around. Finally, he looked up. He saw the sky started to clear. The wind slowed down and the sea calmed. They could stand up again. Captain Lucero and his crew survived and the ship didn't sink. But they had no idea where they were. They thought they were drifting out into the Pacific.
Hindi namin alam na
lumaki. We had no idea the sea had swelled. A storm surge, they called it. So we are floating there thinking we are still in the ocean.
When the massive typhoon crashed onto land, it created a wall of water 17 feet high. It was like a tsunami picked up the Eva Jocelyn.
And suddenly we saw there was a mountain. That mountain there. We were shocked. Where the hell are we?
The mountain was just a few meters away. And when Captain Lucero and his crew tried to get their bearings, the water suddenly receded from beneath them.
Ano na yan eh? Bundok na yan.
We looked outside and we were on land.
The Eva Jocelyn, a massive shipping vessel, was now breached on land in the middle of a crowded slum. Whatever sense of relief the captain felt from living through the storm quickly dissipated. The boat had crushed everything in its path during the storm. The slum, called Anibong, was in ruins, thanks in part to the Eva Jocelyn. The ship was now stuck, 15 feet from a mountainside and 300 feet from the shore, wedged up in the middle of this town. It was the only thing left standing. From the deck, Captain Lucero could see nothing but destruction. Every home was flattened, the ruins covered in black mud. Palm trees and lampposts were snapped in half, and the mountainside was stripped bare. The bodies of the drowned were everywhere. Down below, the people who had survived this thing were bleeding, bruised, and traumatized. And they were looking up at this 150-foot ship perched up on the twisted tin and splintered wood of what used to be their homes.
Many of the crew said to me, they said, let's jump down. I did not let them. Who knows what could happen to them down there? Let's stay here, I told my crew. Nobody leave.
As they looked over the railing, they realized there were some people down below, along the side of the ship. They were caught there when the ocean pulled back, and they stayed there, not knowing what to do.
There was this one family. We did not know they had climbed onto the boat. We just saw them. Suddenly, we just saw them hiding at the side of the boat, so we went to go rescue them. Then we looked over the railing, and there were even more people down there, the side of the ship. So we dropped down the pilot ladder so they could climb up. Yes, they were crying. And some of them were still scared. One guy was trembling. The one that had a big gash here. I gave them some food once the storm calmed down.
The way he saw it, he was the captain and the people that were now on his ship needed him.
I had a little bit of food left over. We boiled a chicken. I had everything cooked just so they would all have something to eat. We even found a pig and carried it up to the ship. They said the owner was already gone, taken by Yolanda.
He pulled 15 people onto the ship. There were countless others wandering around in the ruins. The people of Anibong were completely cut off from the rest of the country. There was no electricity, no cell phone service, no food, no water. And in the hours after the storm, they relied on each other to survive. But soon, what began as a feeling of camaraderie turned into desperation.
It was starting to get dangerous, because there was no food. There was no food at all. Then we started to hear things. The people down there, they were saying that we, well, basically they were cursing at us. Probably because they were so hungry.
There was so much destruction that the government couldn't get to Anibong with help. The people felt abandoned. They were hungry and they were also thirsty, sipping water out of dirty pools just to get a drink. Their wounds were swelling up, getting infected. There was no one to collect the dead. Their neighbors, the people they loved, were rotting, their corpses turning black and bloated. the entire city smelled of death. It went on like this day after day. Amidst this hellscape, that 3,000-ton ship just sat there, unmoving. It became a symbol for Yolanda. Life was hell, and the survivors of the storm needed to be angry at something. So they got angry at this ship.
I do not know. We are not the same people as them. Who knows what they see when they look at us? They were probably thinking, there is the captain. He is the one that brought that ship here. I was scared.
Captain Lucero was waiting to hear from the owner of the ship about what to do.
I told him, sir, it's getting dangerous for us here. People are saying they're going to blow up the ship.
After a month, the roads had been cleared and food and fuel started trickling back. But everyday life in Anibong was still really hard. Nearly all of Captain Lucero's crew left. They couldn't take it anymore. But the captain, he decided to stay. He felt it was his duty. Finally, the owner told him that they needed to swivel this giant cargo ship around and inch it back towards the ocean. But there's one major problem. The Eva Jocelyn is now surrounded by dozens of homes. 3 months have passed since the storm, and the people of Anibong had started to rebuild. One woman set up a little shop in the shade of the boat, selling stewed fish and hot dogs just a couple of feet from the propeller. Men are hammering together the wooden frames of houses steps away from the ship. The butcher cobbled together a little pen, and now his pig is wallowing in the mud underneath the Eva Jocelyn. Captain Lucero knows that getting the ship back to sea means more destruction. What's even worse is that he's the one that has to go door to door to break the news.
I went to each of the houses, the ones that were about to be run over, to tell them that it is nearly time for their house to be destroyed. That was the big problem. There were some people. The storm was still so fresh in their minds. They really had not accepted the idea that it was not our fault. Some of them refused. They said they did not want their homes destroyed. I hated hearing that. I really did not want to hear that. I do not feel like it is my fault. If it was not for the storm, if the sea had not swelled, we would never have ended up here.
Hostility towards the captain's ship grows thick. He begins to worry that someone might take revenge on him. Sometimes he's too scared to climb off the ship, even for a moment.
We have to walk by so many of houses before we get down there, next to the sea. That is where the toilet is. It is kind of far away, and you end up passing a lot of houses, and anyone can just block your way. That's what we were thinking. They can just stop you. So sometimes I just hold it. I just end up holding it.
So Captain Lucero starts lying to the people, promising them they're going to get reimbursed. Meanwhile, he's pleading with his boss to make good on the false promise. But after weeks of wrangling, all he manages to do is get the owner to give each family, whose home is going to be destroyed, 5,000 pesos, which is about $110. It's a tenth of what they think they deserve. So now the people are really angry, and they're angry at Captain Lucero. He goes out of his way to try to appease the people of the slum.
Maybe 50 houses, more than 50 houses. We supplied them with electricity because we have a big generator here. We dropped down a wire and the residents stopped the electricity. Lots of people jump onto it. So that was a help for them because now there's light. We gave it to them like it was nothing, so they would not be so upset.
As months pass, Captain Lucero is exhausted by all the negotiating he's doing. He pleads with the ship owner to have sympathy for the people of Anibong. He feels so guilty and responsible for those living around the ship. At one point, he personally buys a family coconut lumber and corrugated tin roofing. He even builds a bathroom for the neighborhood to share, a little wooden outhouse on the shore.
They would not say it, but they were angry. The people were mad at me. I felt bad for them with everything that has happened, and they do not even have houses to move to.
For 5 months, Captain Lucero tries to make good for the people of Anibong. Then one day, he gets a phone call from his boss. He tells Captain Lucero, out of nowhere, that he's been reassigned to another ship. If he wants to keep getting a salary, he'll have to take this job on a ship that's actually sailing.
I just left the next day. No one knew I was leaving. I did not say goodbye.
In the Philippines, you can't just walk out. It takes hours just to say goodbye. And no one moves out of a place without a party. But Captain Lucero does. He leaves a little cash so the contractors can buy a couple of bottles of gin, but he's too ashamed to stay and drink with them. Instead, he looks one more time over the prow of the ship, at the destruction of the most powerful storm to ever make landfall. He's a lone ship captain in a sea of wreckage. So he packs up his belongings and climbs down the side of the boat.
I just left. I climbed down to the street, and from the street, I went straight out. I just walked away.
Big thanks to Randy Lucero for sharing his amazing story. These days, Randy is no longer the captain of a ship, but he is still sailing. As far as the ship, the villagers decided to chop it up and sell it for scrap metal. The story was produced by Aurora Almendral. To read more of Aurora's work, check out our website, snapjudgment.org. We'll have a link. It was also produced by our own Nancy Lopez, with sound design by Renzel Goriel. You're listening to Snap Judgment, the Detour episode. And when we return, we've got the strangest runaway story you are ever going to hear. In just a moment, on Snap Judgment, the Detour episode continues. Stay tuned.
Want a new podcast to make your weekend pop? Try Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Find out about the best in books, TV, and movies. Pop Culture Happy Hour. You can find it on iTunes under podcasts.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR, the Detour episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and you may remember Aesop. He once told a story about a race, and writer Amelia Gray, she checks back in with the runners several years later. Snap Judgment.
So there I was, running for all my might. This was a woodland course, so things are a little unclear, you know? I'm looking ahead of me, and all I see are branches, right? Maybe a branch looks like another runner, but then I see it's just one of those mossy branches. You know the type.
Hold your breath, please.
And I look behind me. All I see is more branches. And then, you see, then I'm looking behind when up comes this log.
And exhale. And if you could lift your hunch. Yeah,
sure.
And
anyway, up comes... Ouch! Careful where you stick that.
Now, Hare, we need to talk about your condition.
Anyway, up comes this log, and I'm looking behind me, and I don't even see it. Now, this was years ago, mind you, but I was no kid. I had the reflexes, I had the stamina. Oh, I feel woozy. I was no kid.
Hare.
I had the... That's right.
Look, we did a full spectrum analysis after your collapse last week. We took a complete blood count, we did some protein tests, we did some antigen tests, calcitonin tests, alpha-theta protein tests. We did all the tests.
I had the reflexes.
Hare, you have the cancer.
The cancer?
I'm so sorry.
That's not possible. I ran the Laporte circuit last month.
Well, that doesn't mean you're not sick. But we do have a very aggressive treatment plan.
Doctor, sorry to interrupt. Your patient has a visitor.
A visitor?
I'll give you two some privacy. I'll be back later to outline some treatment plans.
Treatment plans? What rot. I wonder who it could be. I haven't seen the March Hare in years. Oh, maybe Cecily Parsley. Maybe she'll sneak in a pint of that cowslip wine. Hello? Hello there? Who's there? This bed is too high up. Come around the side so I can get a look at you. Hello? Is anyone here? Is someone playing a trick on me? It's cruel to play pranks, whoever you are, and I'll have you know that if I had my strength, I'd give you such a thumping.
Hello.
Oh, it's you.
You remember me? I'm the tortoise.
Yes, of course.
We did that race together.
Oh, I remember.
And you were very boastful.
Yes, I remember. I remember you. I'm very well aware of you and our story together. Yes, thank you. They're giving anyone a race these days, just like they're giving anyone a medical license. Did you see that 25-year-old child in here with a stethoscope?
Do you mind if I sit?
The medical industry these days, they want to pump me full of poison and then tell me I'm poisoned. And then, obviously, then the bill comes, which is the real disease.
This chair is very tall.
Just be careful with the IV. Ow! Okay, perfect. Good. Right there. I see you have some flowers taped to your back. Are those for me, or was that a cruel prank?
Those are for you. I can't quite reach.
They wanted to charge me for this piss pot they've stuck under me. Can you imagine it? I told them, if you want to charge me for this, then take it away. Just put some shredded newspaper in the corner, and I'll do it there. But then, of course, they wanted to charge me for the shredded newspaper.
They told me you're dying of the cancer.
Well, that's a delicate way to put it. If you must know, I'm beating the odds. I've been feeling sickly for a while, but I was taking multivitamins and running every day. Then I did a whole body cleanse every 2 weeks. I had a little stumble is all last week, and I'm giving my strength back. Something smells like a pond.
I see.
Everybody's gotta go sometime. You'll go. Maybe you'll get cancer and die next year. I can't imagine you'd have too much trouble succumbing to the odds, as it were. No offense to you, but it takes some mental acuity.
I'm not sure that tortoises can get the cancer.
Those flowers are lovely, by the way. Very nice Easter lilies. Daylilies are my favorite, but they're a bit rare, a bit hard to find. You might find a daylily in a soup if you look in the right place, so you'd have to race across the ocean, but you might just find it in China. Can you imagine a flower in soup? Believe it or not, and I suggest you believe it.
Friend, there was something I wanted to tell you.
Look at what they did to my haunch. They shaved it. I look like I should be hanging in a butcher's shop.
Friend.
I guess you win, buddy.
It was never a race.
Here at the Snap, we wish you the best of luck here. The story was written by Amelia Gray. You can find more of Amelia's work at snapjudgment.org. We'll have a link. And the voice actors for that piece were the Hare, Jason Yamas, the Tortoise, George Garrett, the Doctor, Julia DeWitt. The Nurse was played by Eliza Smith, who also produced that piece with sound design by Leon Morimoto. You know that life often doesn't provide exactly what you want on a silver platter. You've got to work it. Our next story was recorded live at a storytelling gathering across the bay in San Francisco. So go ahead, get cozy, meet Joe Wilcox. He was 19, and Joe didn't know what to do with his life. Snap judgment.
I'd hit the road in an old Chevy Suburban that my godfather had loaned me. And, you know, I was basically walking in the footsteps of the Beats, of Kerouac, and on the road and, like, really seeking the West. I grew up in North Carolina, and I took this long, I call it a driveabout, you know, you do the walkabout in Australia. And I was just on a driveabout. I'd had a little money saved up from odd jobs as a teenager, and I was just spending and living and sleeping in the truck and seeing the West. And I was looking for, you know, I was looking for people that lived off the grid. I was looking to get as far away from society as I could, really. And I wanted to find this, you know, some unseen part of the world, some, like, wild part of the world. And I wound up landing in this place called Detrital Valley, which is about as far as I could get from anywhere and still be close enough to get a cheeseburger, which is really important. And it's about 50 miles north of Kingman, about 50 miles south of the Hoover Dam, right in the middle of nowhere. And you could see the mountains on the other side of Las Vegas from it. And it was just this vast sort of alluvial plain that was incredibly beautiful. And right in the middle of it was this old cafe called Rosie's Den at the Boulder Inn. And around Rosie's Den, there was this cluster of these desert rats that lived. And somehow I had landed at this swap meet run by this somewhat mentally unstable guy. We'll call him Ray, methamphetamine addict, running a swap meet that he on land that he didn't own. Real sketchball, but really fascinating. Used to rant at me about humans were the result of the interbreeding between aliens and apes, and how the Chinese army was going to invade any time, and I needed topographical maps to find my way back, and all this stuff. But it was exciting, you know. I didn't give a and the rest of my friends were, you know, off at college, and I was like, man, this is the Wild West. This is where I wanted to be. And the bartering trade economy out there and the people living, it was very interesting. A lot of old veterans, a lot of just people who were trying to get as far away from society as they could, like me. So things went bad in the desert. And that sounds so cliche, but things went bad in the desert, man. They went bad, bad. And I mean, I'll just give you a quick taste of it. There was a guy, we'll call him, I haven't decided on a name, but let's call him Jeff. And Jeff had killed a guy who had broken into his trailer, and he had a wife and kids in there, and he shot this kid and killed him, and he went to jail for 3 years. I never met this man, but somebody had cut the lock on this guy's shed, and his tools that all had his name on them wandered around the valley. And everybody, this guy was getting out in like a month, and so everybody's getting their tools together, and they're going to put them back in the shed and put the lock back on. but Ray, the guy who owned this swap meet or ran this swap meet, he didn't own it. He had a bunch of stuff that said Jeff, you know, and I was like, hey, man, you know, you got to get that. He's like, oh, no, I traded out for that. You know, I traded a buzzsaw for that or whatever, you know, jackhammer. It was absurd, right? And so I sort of was in the middle of this because I was more or less this guy's errand boy. You know, I was like hanging out and helping him out in order to get room and, you know, enough money to eat, because I'd run out of money by that point. That's sort of an underlying current to this story, is I'm stuck in the desert. So so at one point, I went to this guy, Billy's house, and I was answered by a sawed-off shotgun and a very angry man. And this light went on, that things are going bad in the desert. Things have gone bad. So I got in my truck and I drove south, and I just drove and drove and drove. And I basically had a complete mental nervous breakdown. And I'm 19 years old and I'm at the end of the road. I feel like I gave it my best shot. I tried to find something in the Wild West, and I found more than I could handle. And I just wanted a bath, man. And I just wanted to sleep for a week. So I was headed to my uncle's house down 93, down in Tucson, and I was ready to land and just ready to give up and done with tweakers and desert rats and all the rest. And what happened is I was going to take a different route to Tucson. I was going to go through Saguaro National Forest, and I took a wrong exit off the highway, and I wound up in a little town called Marana. And off to the right side of the road was this big top circus, and it was about 9 at night, and the sun had gone down, the sky was still a little bit dusky, and this thing was lit up like a mirage, you know, and it was beautiful. And I never had seen anything quite like it, because it was small. It was not like a giant, giant big top, but it was, you know, a few hundred feet long. And I drove by it just thinking how beautiful it was, and I was like, man, I got to check it out. So I flipped around, and I drove up, and I walked up to the concession wagon, and I asked him, I asked the guy, there's this big burly dude with tattoos. I was like, hey, how long are you going to be here? And he said, you want a job? And I said, no, I really don't want a job, man. I really am done with the sketchiness. I want to see the circus, you know? He's like, well, we're tearing down the tent right now. He's like, we pay $10 an hour. Help us tear down the tent. You know, tomorrow we're going to be in Tucson. You can come see the show for free. He's like, oh, $10 an hour? You know, I hadn't seen cash, like I said, in a month or so. And then he starts working me. He's like, what are you, 18, 19? He's like, this is the ideal job for a young man like you. You see the country, you got cash money all the time. It's free, you know, expenses are paid. You got a place to stay. You have no bills to pay. He's like, what are you living for now? He's like, what are you doing out here? And he totally had my number. And so I agreed at least to help them tear down the tent. And I was very dubious because he seems somewhat sketchy, but he did, you know, spit a good game. So tearing down that big top was like being swallowed by some crazy machine. It was like 5 minutes after the show ends, the lights are down, the sidewalls dropped, guys are just filing in, there's these dudes like loading poles, and I'm just like swept up in it, and this guy's hollering orders at me. So we're supposed to we get in line, and he's this guy BJ Hebert, was the tent boss at the time, big Yogi Bear looking guy with a ponytail, and he's given us three poles, and we're supposed to take him to the truck. And so I'm in line with all these guys, and I take my three poles to the truck, and I load them up, and I come back, and here's this guy coming at me full bore with like eight poles, and he's got this cigarette that's like all ember, and he goes, get out of the way, and I like duck down, and he goes over me, and I'm watching him, and he comes back, and his shirt says exercise solves everything. And I was like, who is that? I said to somebody, and the guy goes, that's the owner. That's the owner of the whole circus. And so I was to come to know Red Johnson, the owner of the circus, and BJ Hebert, and Lester Moore, and Jimmy Vaughn, and a whole cast of amazing characters, because I joined the show the next day at Lulu Walker Elementary School. I saw them roundhousing sledgehammers, four guys in a circle driving the stakes into the ground. And I said, I want to learn how to do that. And over the course of the next 6 years, so Culpeper and Meriwether Circus would go a different town every day for 8 months with no days off. So 250 towns, 25 states. By the end of the week, I'd seen half of Arizona, and we were into California. I called my parents from Black Canyon City, and I was like, I joined a circus. And they, and this is how traumatized my parents were. They were relieved that I joined a circus. You know, they hadn't heard from me in months. I'd been jumping trains in Mexico. I'd been living in caves in Reno. It was bad, you know. So they saved the little cassette tape. And I went on to work several jobs. I was a curtain guy. I sold Cokes, in addition to putting up the tent and taking it down every day. And then for 1 year, I was the boss of that crew, which was tremendously stressful. And then the last 3 years on the show, I was a show drummer in the live band that accompanied performances. And so all this is from a wrong exit off a highway. So this idea that sometimes you're driving through life, you know, and it might be a wrong exit that you take. But if you can look around, there might be a big top off to the side. And if the conditions of your life are right, and you're willing, you just might get on board. So that's my story.
Just because Joe's not at the circus anymore doesn't mean he's not having fun. These days, he pays the bills by inventing toys. And Joe, we like your style. If you want to hear more stories just like this one, check out the podcast True Story. It's an intimate storytelling affair. We'll have a link on our website, snapjudgment.org. It's that time. But don't fret. Don't frown. No, just subscribe to the Snap Judgment podcast and always have your stories when you need them. You know what I'm saying? Get in the conversation. Got the Facebook, Snap Judgment, Twitter, Snap Judgment. Snap is produced by myself and a team that has made an amazing amount of detours to end up where they are today. Never let them take the wheel. The Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. Get up. Never deny him a beat, Pat Mesiti Miller. Never step on her feet, Anna Sussman. Who's that? Joe Rosenberg on the street? Davey Kim, he keeps his hair real neat. Nancy Lopez likes cereal made from wheat. And Julia DeWitt eats sweets. Wouldn't be complete without Aurora Soria, Eliza Smith, Anna Adlerstein, and Leon Morimoto. And she knows that salads are almost as good as meat. Jasmine Aguilera. Did you ever base jump off of El Capitan at moonlight? Well, neither has the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, because it wouldn't be prudent. Wouldn't be prudent at all. But much love for the CPB. PRX.org exchanges various things for public radios. Clear out your attic and let them know. PRX.org. WBEZ in Chicago insists that WBEZ in Chicago. Even though this is not the news, no way is this the news. In fact, you could find Tupac, Biggie Smalls, and Michael Jackson down at the House of Pancakes playing dominoes with Willie Nelson, and you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.